From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I knew my guest, Amy Koppelman, back when she was just a novelist. She's now a filmmaker. She's adapted her novel, A Mouthful of Air, for the screen, and she's also directed it. Let me bow down, Amy, and say thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
There's so much to talk to you about. I mean, in some ways, with this story, I felt I was kind of watching like the real world version of Rosemary's Baby, because your poor protagonist is surrounded by all these men who think they're giving her the right advice, but she's not really being heard or paid attention in the right way. And she's just looking for honesty. Seeing that play it out reminded me of that section early in the book where your protagonist, Julie, is on the elevator with Philip Roth, and she's aware of the way he's judging him. And then she kind of writes her own scenario. And I kind of thought what you did having men throughout the book is kind of an echo of that.
Knowing that I was going to be on this podcast, I kept thinking, oh my goodness, what's his thesis going to be? And I realized like 15 minutes ago, there's no way I could figure out the thesis. Yeah, you brought up something. I watched Rosemary's Baby before doing this book, and I thought a lot about, you know, what he was saying in that and how she's viewed as a woman. And I do have a lot of male protagonists telling Julie what to do. When I was writing that book, I was thinking a lot about, you know, shame and how much shame women carry, you know, real shame and, you know, the perceived shame that they things they feel guilty about that they're not even responsible for, what we allow for ourselves within the confines of that shame. And so much of that, at least so much of that in my life, was defined by men and what you were supposed to be for them and what your responsibility toward them was.
No, sure. Because again, I was thinking about the way all these men, again, Rosemary's Baby came to mind, but just because, you know, that movie, well, that book in retrospect just seems like it's a metaphor for the struggles, especially in that sort of pre-tolerance era of the way women were treated. And in fact, you can even say that to some extent about the Stepford Wives, but we're talking here about A Mouthful of Air. And again, the way all those men are and sort of the timbre of Edelman's voice, it's all sort of like reassure her. And just being offering this advice that really isn't about listening, and the presumption of him quoting the bell jar to her was kind of astonishing to me.
Wow. Yeah, you picked up on that too. I didn't mean that romantically about Sylvia Plath. I didn't mean that just the way that you inferred. There's something very reductive about that. What I did realize the other day was that her children were 1 and 2 when she killed herself. And I was thinking that it's really interesting that with her, it's always that, you know, her husband was horrible to her and cheated on her versus this idea that, you know, maybe she had very bad postpartum depression and, or, you know, obviously very bad depression. And maybe she killed herself just from those feelings of, you know, self-doubt and, you know, fear of hurting her children. And I was just thinking about why it's easier for us to, with a woman, why we feel that we have to come up with an excuse for bad behavior, especially with mothers. You're taught from when you're a young girl that you're supposed to have this maternal instinct. And I think, you know, many of us define ourselves and our womanhood by this notion of a maternal instinct. And in that, you know, you're not supposed to, like in I Smile Back, Lainey, her acting out, a man can go to Vegas and f- some, you know, woman. And it's like, well, you know, men will be men. But if a mother, you know, f***s to escape, it's like, well, whoa, what does that mean? And she's a horrible person. And I think a woman who has a child and doesn't naturally kick into having this maternal instinct, I think it's especially threatening to men.
No, because I'm glad you brought up my smile back, because I guess to me, the kind of the difference between, and I would like to ask you about this, is the difference between Lainey and Julia is that in her way, Lainey's kind of a fighter. And she is judged and she does do things to correct herself and we're aware of her awareness, but she's going to go down fighting. Whereas in the way you shoot A Mouthful of Air, we're kind of aware of Julie kind of being on her back lot, almost as if she's already kind of down for the count.
When I was trying to figure out what your thesis was going to be, I was sitting here thinking and I realized that I've written three books. It's taken me, you know, 20 something years to write these books. And that I think I'm basically still trying to figure out the same thing, which is, you know, how do you get through life knowing that, you know, you're going to have to say goodbye to everybody that you love? And up until, you know, 10 minutes ago, when I was thinking about this, I would have said, you know, a mouthful of air. I was writing through the fear of what if I hadn't gotten the help that I needed. I smile back. I was writing through the fear of what if I worked so hard to build this little family, but I've inherited the same destructive, cruel behavior as my father. And then in the last book, the main character finally allows herself, she sticks out her tongue to taste the snow and she hesitates. Her daughter, who she adopted, asked her, and then she tastes the snow. And I realized, oh, all I've really actually been writing about this whole time is how do you live with that knowledge that you're marching towards this inevitable goodbye? And Lainey is a fighter. It's almost like she preemptively strikes against them hurting her. She can hurt them and hurt everybody that loves her before they have a chance to hurt her. And that character, and I don't think this ever really came through in the film, was someone who was, you know, bipolar and had borderline personality disorder, which we didn't really talk about then. And, you know, her behavior was really much more symptoms of that. But ultimately, if you take the word, you know, mental illness away, it's just a woman who's so scared and fearful of that moment, of that pain. You're right. I think it's different for Julie because Julie sees all the beauty in the world and she wants to be good enough to almost like meet that beauty. And she just can't help but thinking that the best thing that she could do for her family is to live in the world without her. And I think a lot of that is just fear of, you know, how is she going to hurt them and what it's going to be like when, you know, you have to say goodbye. So I was almost relieved realizing that that's still the same question I'm trying to figure out, even though it's a very simple question. I think for the depressed person, the volume of that question, you just can't control the volume. And she's always trying to put it out, but she can't.
By the way, it's the treatment, my guess is, novelist turned filmmaker Amy Koppelman, her film debut as director is the adaptation of her book, A Mouthful of Air. I have to say, I kept finding myself thinking about that title so often because you can't help but think, you know, golly, she could just get in enough air and clear her head because we're so aware of her being inside so often. But when she leaves, then she's really at risk. And this just seems to be the only place she can sort of get a clear breath really is in the narration of the and the character and this idea you create for the character as played in the movie. She's a children's author who's given her character, Pinky, a kind of power that she herself doesn't have.
No one in their right mind would ever think that this particular three-act structure should be made into a film. And I had no intention of making it into a film until I was on the West Side Highway one day and I was listening to, I guess, doctor's radio and a woman called in. And she was standing by her ironing board and a baby, I guess her baby was asleep and she was crying and crying. And they explained to her, you know, well, you have postpartum depression. You should call a doctor. And she said, no, I couldn't possibly. You should tell your partner. I couldn't possibly. You should speak to your priest. I couldn't possibly. And I remember thinking, oh, I thought everybody knew about this. And I realized still so many women, you know, were harboring this secret. And getting to your answer about the mouthful of air, I remember thinking at that moment, maybe if I could work really hard, I could figure out how to write a movie because people don't really read as much. And maybe I'd be able to get to her. Well, it'd be too late to get to her, but to somebody like her and just say, just like, you know, it sounds so silly and cheesy, but, you know, just take one more breath, like just get to the next moment. So that was my mission with this film. And I guess in everything I write, and I guess even to myself, you know, just to keep on breathing.
I mean, I don't think it's cheesy or corny at all, because I do feel like that becomes the tension in the movie, actually, is for her to just find that moment of calm. Because if you've read the book, we know what's going to happen. And Amanda Seyfried, it's so great in it just because she does this thing physically, and I'm sure this is one of the reasons you cast her, is that the book is taking place kind of in real time. You need somebody to inhabit that character in that kind of real-time way. She's responding to the world as it's happening to her. Because of the way the book, the movie is framed, I'm not going to give too much away. We need to have an actor who can live in it in real time the way that that she does, don't you?
One of the hard things about adapting in a book that's as interior as this is that you can't use the exposition that you can use as a novel writer. And, you know, you don't have the white space between paragraphs, which I understand much more than I understand in directing. And she was able to, through her eyes, you know, inhabit the character, as you said, in real time, and show through her reactions, big and small, in her eyes, all the exposition, much more than I had even thought of writing. And I think her performance is miraculous. It's to play a role of a woman who is, like I was saying, you know, unable to fulfill her duties as a woman. I do think that what's really interesting is that in the beginning and the end and the movie poster, the moment that she is her most calm and her most sure of herself is when she's ready to, you know, take her life at the end. I'm not worried about spoilers because I think I think it's pretty obvious. But because she's so sure that what she's doing is the right thing. I wish I was a bigger person than I am. And I hadn't, you know, read reviews or got hurt by reviews. But one of the things that I was surprised by was that people didn't understand that, you know, what her pain meant and the why she felt this way. And again, when I was sitting here trying to think of what you had asked me, I was thinking that, you know, that's, I think, a big part of the problem, not only in being a writer or an art, but just being a human. You know, we forget to ask, like, the intention of it. You know, what's the intentionality of that person? You know, what was she trying to say or to do? And the things that you're bringing up were all my intentions. So thank you.
Given the sort of the intimacy of the material, there's a real momentum because we're trying to keep up with these characters' thoughts. So to do that thing that happens in the movie where you give us this sort of ideal look at who she is at the very beginning, and then we slowly get a sense of the thread unraveling, you need somebody who can live in the moment in that way. And I just thought stripping the narrative down and putting that much faith in your actor was a real director's decision to make.
When I sent the book to Amanda and I went and met with her, she said, "I will do this, but you can't direct it. You're too close to it. You can't direct it." And I said, okay. Even though I thought that I Smile Back wasn't what I wanted it to be, it was still existed. And, you know, the people who understood it found it. And then we spent like a year looking for a real director to direct it. And finally, this one very good director said to her, "Nobody is going to direct this movie because she," meaning me, "is supposed to direct it." And so I knew, because I haven't put in the time, you know, the Malcolm Gladwell hours of learning how to direct, I just thought, okay, I'm not going to be able to understand how to manipulate the camera to help her. I just have to shoot everything very uninflected, almost like if it were just a play. And I need to not wear headphones. I hardly ever wear headphones. I just need to set up the shot and then get really close to her. And if I can feel her and feel, you know, the emotion and the psychological place that she's supposed to be in, if I can feel her just human to human, then, you know, the camera will capture that because she's miraculous on a screen. And so we stayed very close to each other and she just gave me everything she had.
My guest, who has just proven that Malcolm Gladwell's theorem is a shibboleth, is Amy Koppelman. Her directorial debut is A Mouthful of Air. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm thrilled to have here as my guest, Amy Koppelman. You know her as a novelist. She's now shown some real accomplishment as a director, adapting her book, A Mouthful of Air. And you were talking about I Smile Back, and I think the difference for me between these two movies is that movie judged the characters, and this one does not.
I think that is me being the director. I love all these characters. I think Lainey is a good person. She just is a good person who does bad things. I'm not that judgmental of a person, so maybe that's why. And maybe that's what I was talking about before, about the asking why. So yes, I don't judge Julie's actions. Although, you know, my husband would say she's the worst person in the world. Look what she does. You know, she leaves her family, you know, and she traumatizes them. And that is true. And I do understand that, you know, this is not an act of kindness on her part. She isn't sparing them the pain of being her mom, but in her mind, she thinks that she is. And so I forgive her for those reasons. But, you know, there's this big thing about, you know, a happy ending and redemption, and depression is so often portrayed that way. I mean, you know, at the end of Silver Linings Playbook, Bradley Cooper, you know, and they're dancing. And I mean, that's a movie that people love, and it's good because people talked about bipolar illness. But for me, the happy ending is for the viewer to make different choices than my characters make, you know, to see this movie. And if you see yourself in this movie, or you see somebody you love in this movie, that, you know, you take them or help them get the help that they need. Because again, it sounds so silly and so cheesy, but, you know, suicide, it's never the right answer. And it doesn't ever spare the people that you love. And that's basically my mission, is if there was a way for me, even in some small way, and Amanda and I both thought this, to get to one person, like that one woman by the ironing board, and help one person not take their own life, then, you know, all the struggle to get the movie to be made would be worth it.
Part of this too is, I was going to touch again on the Philip Roth sighting early in the novel, is that, first of all, where we are now with Philip Roth, that is a really painful vignette to think about, but also the judgment of his characters. I mean, if Lainey were the, and she could have been the protagonist of When She Was Good, then it would be about the damage she's doing instead of understanding who she is and her awareness of self. And again, that's the thing that I think as a filmmaker you brought to this, maybe a fine line difference between this and I Smile Back, is we have a sense of her awareness. And you were talking about what Brian, your husband, said about her being a bad person because she took her own life and left this family behind. And her sister-in-law steps up, played so well by Jennifer Carpenter here. And it also brings to mind, for me too, the interactions that she has with women in this, between their sister-in-law and her mother. The way they live their lives as compared to the men who are, have this kind of sureness even when they're wrong.
People always ask me, you know, is this book autobiographical? And of course it's not autobiographical, but, you know, all the feelings of shame and self-doubt in it are mine. And a couple vignettes in it are mine. And the Philip Roth thing actually happened. I lived in the same building when I was young as Philip Roth. And, you know, after I had my son, it was when he was having an affair with Mia Farrow. And I remember at 5 o'clock, when my son would be crying, I would go and sit in the lobby, you know, hoping to get a glimpse of Mia Farrow passing through the lobby. But I remember there was this one moment where I had had makeup on and I was wearing a leather jacket, and he offered me a ride. And I remember being so excited and calling Brian and going, "Brian, you won't believe it. Philip Roth, you know, offered me a ride." And I knew, like, oh, this meant that I looked good because, you know, Philip Roth, like, thought I was hot enough to, you know, offer me a ride in his car. And I remember when I was pregnant, getting into the elevator and thinking, once he realizes that I'm pregnant, he is never going to offer me a ride again. Now, of course, you know, I'm having this whole conversation with Philip Roth that he's not even, you know, remotely part of. But And then there was this moment, I remember pushing the stroller into the elevator with Philip Roth and like putting my eyes down and diverting my eyes. Cause like, oh God, you know, the shame of the fact that I had become a mother, you know, there was nothing sexual left about me. But yes, Philip Roth in context. Yeah. Philip Roth's a whole fun other conversation, but yes, he judges his characters also, you know, it's interesting, you know, who he makes heroic and not heroic, but yes, I think he does judge women a lot. And he never did offer me a ride again.
Well, as we say where I'm from, you're much better off. My guest who escaped a ride with Philip Roth by apparently the skin of her leather jacket is Amy Koppelman. She's a first-time filmmaker whose new film is the adaptation of her novel, A Mouthful of Air. I guess I'm bringing this up, though, because by making this movie you made, by it being really a reduction of what the book is in the best ways. Like I think about how when she's with her mom and her mom is putting the clips on her face to show what it would be like after plastic surgery, that awful telling line that Julie remembers as a kid, her mother saying to her, well, your father doesn't love us anymore. I mean, subtextually, because the mom's getting older and he was always deriding her for having had children and getting older. But even Lainey in I Smile Back judges herself for that. And it's just, as you mentioned, the beauty that Julia sees, but also just being reminded, as any parent will tell you, that when you have a child, you're aware of your own mortality. But also for women, it becomes this awareness of the mortality of the perception of their beauty.
Yeah, and the perception of, you know, their value on earth. I mean, I've been working on this new novel of mine for years and years, and I think it's about one thing, and I know that it's going to ultimately end up being about menopause. And I'm joking, but I'm not joking. But, you know, I think it's about real estate. I guess I do spend a lot of time thinking about, I mean, I don't like to talk in terms of like, you know, societals, play. I'm not intellectual that way. But, you know, as women, what, you know, what our value is and or what we're socialized to believe our value is. And at least in the way I was brought up, the value was always to serve a man. And, you know, if he lost interest in you and, you know, didn't want to be with you, that's on, you know, was on you. The best thing that happened to me in this whole thing was my daughter called me. She's 21 now. And she said, I was speaking to my therapist today, you know, as she was, and she said, you know, she gave you a real compliment. And I said, really? You know, I was so excited that I got a compliment from her therapist. And she said, yeah, she said, you broke the cycle. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, I didn't grow up in a house that was brutal toward women in any way. You know, basically there was no abuse in my house and she's allowed to be who she wants to be. And I didn't damage her. I mean, I'm sure I f***ed her up, but like, you know, I didn't completely ruin her. And hearing that from her after all these years later of writing this book and, you know, this terrible fear I had, you know, both of that goodbye that I'll have to make to them. Hopefully it all is in the right order. And, you know, it's Brian and I going first. That's really the best you can wish for. But also this idea of, you know, how I would fail them, how I would hurt them, or how I wouldn't be able to protect them. Because, you know, you have these babies and they look at you and they're so innocent and it's your job to protect them and to keep them safe. And I think often when you become a parent, all the tools that you had to help you survive, all the ways you're able to subjugate, you know, your own feelings or your own memory, they stop working. And so, you know, you're forced to reckon with the ways in which you weren't protected. And so when she called me and she said that to me and I thought, okay, well, I got her to 21 and she's okay. But that made me feel good and it made me feel proud. And pride's not like a big thing for me, but to know that I raised two good human beings and that I raised a daughter who doesn't define herself by what the men in her life think of her, that felt like a giant accomplishment I didn't even know I was trying to accomplish.
I just found myself thinking that it kind of bridges, again, so much literature. I mean, like Rosemary's Baby or The Yellow Wallpaper, or there's so many things that come to mind. and I know we've even talked about Joan Didion before, but so many of those things are about trying to react to a judgment. And there's a kind of purity to this here, in that this is really Julia's illness that you're dealing with. And by staging it so carefully and giving, creating this character again, who's not, well, you make her an illustrator, children's book author here in the movie, this character who has this flaw, but who uses that flaw to make herself capable and to have a place in the world. And I mean, all these things you've done are really about making us understand that you're not going to sensationalize Julia's condition, but ask us for empathy. And as you were saying, the reviews that were, that bothered you in some way, I'm guessing they wanted a more glib treatment or a more hysterical treatment, both of which are the kinds of things we're used to seeing or even reading in this area. And you don't do that.
Well, I have spent my life trying to advocate for mental illness and trying to explain that depression is an illness, you know, no different than asthma or diabetes. And so maybe you're right. Maybe the reason I don't judge them is because you wouldn't judge somebody, you know, with cancer. And so I would really like people to know and to get help and to take medicine. You don't have to have any experience with trauma, with postpartum depression. This could be a one-off. I remember it took a very long time for me to take antidepressant medication. I didn't start taking it till my son was like almost two. And when I took it, all the cliches were true. Like everything did go from black and white to color, and all the false information about it wasn't true. Like I remember at the time people saying, oh, well, you'll never be able to write anything and you won't be able to feel anything. And, you know, you're never going to want to have sex. And, you know, I don't know anybody who's in a deep depression who gets anything written. I surely never got anything written depressed. And, you know, it's not true. If you need medication, it does exactly what an inhaler does. It makes you be able to breathe and know that there's basically like a trampoline under you. And so when you're in free fall, you know that there is something that's going to catch you. And I hope that this movie makes it to the people who need it and that they'll get the help that they need. And I really wanted to make a movie about somebody who, it wasn't all emo. She does see the beauty and she appreciates the beauty. And it's somewhat that beauty that crushes her. But, you know, you don't have to be that way. The other thing people would always say is that, you know, to be an artist or a writer, you know, you need to have some kind of depression. But I always think, you know, imagine the paintings Van Gogh would have painted, you know, or the, you know, melodies Cobain would have made.
We're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this. And I would also say for people who just want to be moved by film, this is a terrific thing to see. And I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My guest is novelist turned filmmaker Amy Koppelman. Her directorial debut is the adaptation by herself of her novel, A Mouthful of Air. Our recording engineer, who's part of our production staff, is Katie Gilchrist. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.